Welcome to today's NCPA Simplify My Meds Lunch and Learn webinar. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. A question and answer session will follow the presentation, and instructions for asking questions will be given at that time. If at any time during your conference you require operator assistance, please dial *0 and your line will be intercepted privately. Thank you for your attention. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Tina Schlett.
Thank you, Angie. Good afternoon, and welcome to this month's Adherence Lunch and Learn. My name is Tina Schlett, and I will be your host for today's call. I'm the director of NCPA's LTC Division and Pharmacy Affairs, as well as a member of NCPA's Adherence Team. This month's call is part of NCPA's Simplify My Meds program. For those of you who are not yet taking advantage of this member benefit, Simplify My Meds is a free adherence program for NCPA members. It provides you with the tools you need to set up a medication synchronization program in your pharmacy. By coordinating your patient's prescriptions to be refilled on the same day each month, you are able to help your patients improve adherence while streamlining your own pharmacy operations. Pharmacies using this model have seen an increase in prescription volume, a decrease in labor costs, as well as lower inventory costs. You can calculate the potential revenue you are missing using our new medication synchronization refill calculator. The link to the calculator is shown on the screen. As an NCPA member, you can receive a pharmacy operations manual, downloadable forms that can be customized to your pharmacy, and a free marketing kit that includes bag stuffers, brochures, posters, and other materials to help you promote this program to your patients. To sign up, please visit the website located on the screen or send us an email to the address located on the screen as well. Also, be sure to check out our online tutorial that provides step-by-step directions for setting up and running a medication synchronization program. Now I am pleased to introduce today's speaker. Jerry Meese is a pharmacist, certified diabetes educator, and owner of Plaza Pharmacy and Wellness Center in Gainesville, Texas. In 1997, Jerry received the national recognition for his diabetes program and was given the Innovative Practitioner of the Year Award by the Texas Pharmacy Association. He has spoken across the country and internationally on the topic of diabetes, disease state management, and clinician-patient behavior in the healthcare setting. So it's my honor to introduce Jerry. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Tina, and good afternoon to everybody. I hope in the next hour that we have together, going through the thoughts and slides for this preparation is, my thinking was, how do we talk about how we talk to patients effectively. So hopefully you'll be able to take away a couple of nuggets or pearls. Some of you are doing great work out there. We could all use some tips and improvement. It's one of my passions is trying to join behavior change and technology in the world that we live in. So let's go ahead and get started with maybe how to have more productive conversations with our patients. See if I can make the technology work, I do. So what has been your experience with trying to facilitate behavior change in your patients? Usually when I do a workshop like this, in where I have 30 people in a room, the eyes start rolling in the back of their head, and they say, what's been my experience? People are don't want to change, or they have a hard time changing. And that's often the case. Change is hard. We have to recognize that. And what I want to us to think about is not only what has been, you know, our work with patients in change, what's been your own work? How many of you out there have been trying to lose weight? So you say as your goal, I'm going to lose 10 pounds. Or you say as your goal, I'm going to exercise my New Year's resolution, you know, 5 days a week. I'm going to eat better. And we know how long sometimes those resolutions last. So when it's hard for us as professionals, think how hard it is for our patients. We're all, kind of all in the same boat. What about change? Change occurs, and this is the one thing I think we need to recognize with all our patients. Change occurs. Behavior change occurs. gradually, over time. The patient usually starts out uninterested, exercise, weight loss, considers it. He decides to change. He makes his decision. He decides to take action, and then he has to maintain it. And through all these what are called stages of change, patients go back and they go forward. They drift back into not doing it. They go forward. You know how you do. That's how our patients do. And so we have to recognize that it's not just a straight linear step to stop smoking, get more exercise, taking our medications correctly. We fall back. Things happen. We introduce these phrases now, and the phrases that I'd like to throw out, you know, that we're going to talk about are adherence, compliance, healthcare coaching, chronic care. You know, the bottom line is, you know, how do we deal with patients every day, recognize their barriers, and help them arrive at solutions? This is the basis of all healthcare coaching, chronic care coaching. And if you see in front of you right there, you've got several disease states. There's more chronic disease states, but these are probably the top ones: COPD, obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, asthma. A lot of the examples I refer to as a diabetes educator, of course, are with diabetes. But I can tell you this. 80% of all chronic care management is identical. It's about getting patients to work to help themselves. The other 20% is in the medications, the very specific ways we would handle a specific disease. COPD is different than diabetes, but 75-80% of that is all the same. In every one of these cases, the patient has to take charge, and probably we build it around the big three, even though there's other, certainly, healthcare behaviors, coping, you know, pressure, et cetera, with that. But if you look at this, the big three are medication, physical activity, and nutrition. You can go to any chronic care case, and every one of these have to fall into place along with monitoring. Monitoring may be self-monitoring blood glucose and diabetes, but monitoring is a peak flow meter in asthma. So our patients have to do this, and they have to be adherent to every one of these. Of course, as pharmacists, we focus and concentrate on medication adherence, which is extremely important. But medication adherence is just one part of a three-legged stool. They can be taking their medication perfectly, but if they're not going to get off the sofa or they're eating three Whataburgers a day, it's not going to help us with the rest of their overall chronic care. So how well are we really doing? Well, if you look at this graph right here or this slide, what you see is that percent of diabetes patients are in control in all three areas: lipids, blood glucose, and blood pressure. 14%. 86% of them are out of control or not at goal in one of those three areas, which means we lose them to a disease that wasn't well controlled. 23% of the patients, and again, if we go to diabetes, self-monitoring blood glucose, 23% in 2010 just stopped testing altogether. 25% of all the prescriptions called in or written for chronic care diseases were never picked up, and that definitely affects our bottom line. And if patients are taking five or more prescriptions, they're taking them wrong 50% of the time. That's the world we live in. This is backed up by the World Health Organization, by the way, in which it mentions that people suffering chronic care diseases average only 50% adherence rates. If you drill down to a disease, patients taking any drug or a combination drug for hypertension in our country are adherent only 51% of the time. So we've got a ways to go. We've got some problems to work on. So if we were to say, why is this important? Well, biggest problem we have is that they're out there looking right now, Medicare, CDC. What people are working on is, how do I fill this void that we have in this area? We know this, what we've been doing for the last 50 years hasn't worked. If pharmacists don't do this, if we don't step up to the plate and become chronic care managers, someone else will. Someone will fill that gap, because it is a much-needed gap recognized by healthcare across America. If you look at what Medicare is doing right now, the Centers for Disease Control, they're looking for answers. I talk to people on a weekly basis that have discussions about how can we do this better, and, of course, I keep throwing up this group of professionals called pharmacists, and probably in the last 10 years, we just started gaining that recognition as people that would sit down and actually affect chronic care management. In the last 5 years, we've gained a lot of momentum because we're starting to get good results, better outcomes. Centers for Disease Control has a huge program right now in how to counsel for prevention of diabetes. Google that and look that up. One of my favorite verbs is Google. So start looking at that. And the bottom line is they're looking for professionals to sit down, talk to patients effectively, and have conversations that will change behavior. The other reason it's important for us as a profession, we have to become very skilled and good at talking to people in a way that will allow them to save their own lives. There's not enough of us to go around to work with every patient all the time to do better care with them. We have to teach them how to take care of themselves. Why is that important? Look at the difference in the times, in the time spent in medical care for a patient on chronic care. They're on their own 99.98% of the time. That's incredible. They're in our care only 0.02% of the time. So if you look at this situation, pointing your finger and waving it and saying you've got to lose weight or you've got to go out there and walk 5 miles a day or you need to take this pill 4 times a day and let them leave, here's your medication. It's important you take it every day, and you give them 30 seconds of time. It's not doing the job. It's not working for us. This is our whole process that's failing us right now. We used to be in acute care healthcare system. People died of pneumonia. They died of diphtheria. They died of infection. No longer is that true in this century. Now people die of chronic disease. They live much longer. And we're still trying to do acute care management in a chronic care world. So how do we fix something like this? How do we work on issues that, for example, cost us $100 billion a year, 125,000 deaths? How do we become better at managing chronic care? Well, one of the issues we could say is defining definitions that we've been tossing around pretty loose over the last few years. I get on a regular basis physicians that send me charts and say, this patient was non-compliant. Hope you can help him. Good luck to you. That's not necessarily the words we want to start using in chronic care management. Compliance means I'm going to shake my finger at you. As one patient told me at one point, going to his doctor was a lot like going to the principal's office. I tell him the mistakes I made. He points my finger at me and says, I've got to do better. And I walk away with my head down. That's compliance. How well you do and follow what I say. Adherence is what we're all trying to achieve. Adherence to medication taking, adherence to exercise, adherence to nutrition. Adherence means that you and I are going to come up with a plan, and we're going to talk about you applying a plan that we both agreed on. We're both sitting on the same side of the table. We're talking about barriers. We're talking about other areas that might prevent you from getting your medication in, and we're talking about ways to arrive at a solution to that. Persistence is adherence over time. Some statistics point to the fact that a third of all the patients that started on lipid therapy, which is a good example, quit it after the first year. A third of all our patients taking lipid therapy. So it cost us, cost the healthcare system a fortune. Poor adherence leads much more frequently to heart attacks, strokes, and things that cost us much, much more than what our medication taking does. So if we know that adherence is important, what are the reasons for poor adherence? Why don't our patients do better? I think that one of the key facts we need to mention is that patients want to have a good, long, healthy life. They want to do better. They're motivated. The fact is that sometimes they're confused. The World Health Organization did a survey and said that poor patient communication with providers was a key factor. 21% of the people that walked out of a clinician's office didn't agree on the decisions that were made and didn't agree on the course of action. So someone, for example, told a patient, you've got to lose 20 pounds. They didn't agree either that was important, that they needed to, or they didn't know what course of action to take. A patient was talked about by a physician to start on insulin, but they didn't agree that that was the case they needed to have. They had no plan for implementing the recommendations. They had a poor understanding of the plan to begin with. How do I go about losing 20 pounds? You've got a sheet with some nutrition scale on here. I'm not sure if I understand it. And probably the worst is enthusiasm or the lack of execution by the healthcare provider. I've ran into this before, in which physicians said, you know, you can go to Jerry's diabetes education program. Hope it's not the, my key physicians, but if you want to, it's nice. It'd be good if you went. If you don't want to, it's okay. But think of the difference in that and saying, as some of my physicians say, and I'm probably some of yours, it's very important that you go sit through this course. It will help you. You'll benefit from it. You'll feel better. So enthusiasm is an important thing when we're talking to patients about their care. So for a patient to be adherent, they have to fully understand and comprehend the overall plan that's going to take place. If I mention to you, and we're working on a diabetes prevention program, which may be one of the most important things that comes up in the pharmacy is prevention and dispensing of information. If I sit down with you and we talk about an exercise program, so you're telling me that, okay, maybe I can walk around a block every day, and I'm saying to you, you need to walk a mile a day, 5 days a week. We don't agree. So I have to kind of go along with you. You're in charge of your own health care. If your goal is to walk around a block every day, 5 days a week, I have to say it's a start. You're in agreement, and if you don't walk around a block 5 days a week, then you're non-adherent. You agreed to it, but you're not carrying it out. That's different. We talk about what may have happened to the executionist. Was it bad weather? Is there a place you can get more exercise? Maybe going to the mall. So it's important that we agree, and just as important that we do follow-up to say, how did this work? You've been trying this for 2 weeks. At Plaza, we call these experiments. What's going to be your experiment when we're holding classes? Well, my experiment is to be I'm going to go walk 30 minutes 5 days a week. When you come back and report back in 2 weeks later, you didn't get it done. Well, the experiment failed. You didn't. So in that length of time, maybe what we talked about was, what do you think was the biggest barrier? Well, I didn't realize the weather was going to be that terrible. I didn't realize that I just didn't feel like doing it. And so we talk about solutions. How do we arrive at solutions? And we'll look at that in a few minutes about how we can address that issue. This is probably one of the biggest factors we have with chronic care. If you look at this, this is what our patients have to go through. If you have diabetes or you're obese or you have hypertension, we're talking about you keeping records, maintaining your physician's appointments, your diet, your exercise, glucose monitoring, peak flow meter monitoring. How does the environment at work influence you? Can you do it? What about the cultures? And cultures aren't just religion. They're not in one factor or another. They can be all sorts of things that influence how you act. What's your belief in your ability, and how well do you think this stuff really works? If I start you on insulin, do you think it really helps? Probably a key factor is finance. Can you afford the medicines you're taking? If you look at what could take place in about a 10-minute physician encounter, we see right in front of us here that I stopped into a doctor's office, and now he wants to talk to me about, in this case, diabetes. He wants me to walk 30 to 45 minutes 5 days a week. We've got to get your A1C down. Watch your salt intake. Maybe you're not going to eat anything white. Check your blood sugar. Take your diabetes meds, all of them at bedtime except your lipids. Take it at bedtime and your others after a meal. So you can see where, you know, status overwhelm us really sets in very rapidly. This is what it looks like probably to the poor patient when he leaves a physician's office after either getting his first hit with either asthma, obesity, diabetes. The physician has everything on his checkoff list. It's all taken care of. And the patient walks out of there saying, how do I know I need it? Where do I go to walk? I hate to walk to begin with. That's not even my preferred exercise. What's a lipid? What side effects bother me? How much is this going to cost me to begin with? Interesting point to bring up in our day and age of expensive medicines. And even when he gets everything resolved, when everything is taken care of and he's on an even keel, life happens. Typical examples, I had a patient who was in under good control. Two shots a day of insulin, everything working fine, eating right, but he did this with his wife's support. Took him a while for them both to arrive at something. He was on an even keel. A1C was down really well. Medication adherence was up remarkably good. He was 100% adherent to his medications simply because his wife said, this is what you're going to do. His wife died. He fell off the tracks. He's off the rails. And so when we have everything we think, the boat going in the right directions, this is what happens. So it's not just a matter of getting someone under control for a little while. It's how do we follow up and how do we touch base to make sure that they stay that way. And concerning the finances, the diabetes patients or any chronic care patient tell their doctors when they cut back on medication use due to cost. Pettit did a study on this, and it's been cited over and over again. And the fact is they didn't tell him. And when he asked in his interviews, why didn't you tell your doctor that you couldn't afford your medication? Answers were, I didn't trust my providers enough. It wasn't long enough time during the visit. I didn't think it was important. I felt embarrassed about this. Didn't think they could help. Incredibly, and we all should have egg on our face for this, the number one reason for this was no one ever asked me. A colleague of mine that went through one of my workshops, I think, had a great example of this. He wrote me back, and he said, I plugged in something that I thought you should know about. The patient went to a physician. He was on metformin. Everything was good for the patient, but the doctor wasn't getting the results he wanted, so he needed to add another drug. He added a DPP-4, Januvia, to the medication regimen. Oddly enough, he still wasn't getting any improvement. So after a period of time, the doctor said, we're going to now have to stick you on Lantus. So the patient walks into the pharmacist shop, and the pharmacist looks over his meds, and something struck him. He came back to the patient. He said, I'm looking at your medication. Your Januvia is lasting twice as long as I would expect it to. In a given period of time, say a month, how many doses do you think you miss of Januvia? The patient never hesitated. He said, oh, I can tell you. I miss half of them. I take a Januvia every other day. I can't afford to take this drug. And now that you're putting me on this insulin, I'm going to have to take the insulin every other day. Good catch by the pharmacist, which with a phone call to the doctor and a change of medications and a revamping of the regimen, he got a medication regimen the patient could agree to, could work with, and could afford. I was told a long time ago that the most expensive medication that's ever been presented is the one that isn't taken. So having our patients agreeing to something that may not be perfect but is good is something that we can really do to increase adherence and improve outcomes, you know, overall. So just an example of what can take place when we just have conversations with the patients, and more of how this pharmacist asked that question in just a minute. The other part of this is that solutions aren't easy, and we need to be aware of the fact that there's not a single strategy that works for everyone. I've talked to diabetes educators, nurse practitioners, NPs, PAs, physicians across the country, and one of the things that always kind of makes my skin crawl in the back is when someone says, this is what I do, this is the way I work with everyone. No single strategy works for everyone. Interventions have got to be tailored to the individual. Every person, we need to remember so strongly is that every person looks at the world through a different window. And we have to put ourselves in those shoes and see how that works. This is the phrase that has kind of disappeared into the ether of clinical care. It's called communication, and it's what we've lost over the years. Maybe we didn't even have it at some point, but it's what we definitely need to get better at. Communication, exchanging of information or ideas or news. In other words, how do we get the most information from a patient and give the most information back in the most effective amount of time? This takes practice, it takes time, it takes skills to make that work. Key phrase and a takeaway from today would be that patients almost always have the answers within them if we allow them to think it through. It takes a little time, but it's our job to help them find their own motivation and their own solutions. I usually use a phrase to describe this as what's underneath your car, and we tend to, it's something that we use over and over our workshop is finding out what's underneath their car. This was timely, April 10th. Last week. These two girls actually lifted this 3,000-pound tractor off their dad. He got pinned under it. He flipped it over. They were out there working with him, and they did something that's not humanly possible. Each one grabbed a wheel, lifted it up, and let him crawl out from underneath it. The steering wheel was crushing him, and he couldn't breathe. He was going to die. The most important thing in these girls' lives at this point were their dad trapped under a tractor, and it caused him to do something, again, that was not humanly possible. What we're looking for all the time that we're talking to patients is we're assessing and we're looking for what's underneath their tractor, what's underneath their car, what's underneath them that is so important that they would do something that they normally would never do. Sometimes what's underneath someone's tractor is, I want to watch my grandkids grow up. I want to dance at my son's wedding. I want to play 18 holes of golf. I haven't done it in 5 years. So while you're having conversations, you're always kind of doing a little detective work is what is really the chord that strikes this. So I thought this was kind of a pertinent example of what can take place. You do this with this skill, and motivational interviewing is an art form all its own. It is it's something that, you know, I've studied in practice, and I think a lot of us get exposed to, but we don't get good at it unless we practice it on a regular basis, unless we really break it down. A book I would refer you to is called Health Behavior Change by Rolnick, R-O-L-L-N-I-C-K. But the book Health Behavior Change, go to Amazon or whatever and look it up, is an incredibly good practical book for how to do motivational interviewing better. If you look at what we have when we do motivational interviewing, we're doing what's called CORE, goal setting, collaboratively, open-ended questions, reflective listening, empathy. Motivational interviewing is not telling someone what to do. If you tell someone that you've got to lose 10 pounds, if you tell someone that they have to walk 5 miles a day or that they have to take their insulin every day, they're going to automatically come up with reasons why they shouldn't. They're going to come up with a negative. Our goal in MI is to find the underlying motivation in the patient by exploring their ambivalence and their resistance. What barriers might you find? What do you think might not work? Why do you think it's important? But overall, the responsibility for the change is left to the patient. We can't motivate a person. They have to find the motivation from within themselves. So we use different methods. The CORE part, the O part of CORE is, after we've set goals together, is to ask open-ended questions. You notice the pharmacist that ask the patient about his adherence mentioned, in a given month, how many times do you think you miss taking your medication? It's very likely that if we ask a patient, are you taking your medication right, they're going to say yes. The last thing we want to do when interviewing and talking to a patient is ask yes or no questions. Some are going to pop up, but by far and away, the majority is to ask open-ended questions. The goal of MI in asking open-ended questions is to get a story from the patient. So you're going to hear phrases like, tell me in a typical day how you would go about getting your exercise, or what do you think the barriers might be in taking your insulin? How would you go about checking your blood glucose out in public? We try to refer or defer from asking the why questions, because when someone says, I'm not able to walk 5 days a week, and you say, why aren't you? It seems like all of a sudden we're accusing them or something. So we try to avoid that. If a person can answer one, you know, in one yes or no answer, it's probably not open-ended, and that's not really where we want to end up being. We want to have them talking more than we are. Here's the biggest fears that probably everyone out there is talking about if they haven't done a lot of this. It's what doctors worry about when we talk to them, is that if I ask open-ended questions, they're going to talk all day. They're going to ramble on. Honestly, study after study says they won't. They'll answer questions, and if they do, we have ways with practice of saying in the time we have allocated, can you tell me what a typical day would be? The other fact is that we're so anxious to make sure that we don't miss anything, that if we don't dig in and give them 12 facts right away, then we're going to forget something. Make notes in advance. Know that you are going to reach them, and honestly, these two things just don't happen as often. The only time we remember is when they do. So it may be 5% of the time. The other part of motivational interviewing is reflective listening. Reflective listening is just being present. Do you ever talk to someone and at a party, and all the time they're talking to you, they're looking over your shoulder, they're looking around, they're identifying other people in the room? You know they're not listening to you. Being present is really harder than what we think, especially in a busy pharmacy. We need to set aside that time, that specific amount of time. We need to show them we're trying to understand and listen to what they're saying. One of the examples of being a mirror reflecting the speaker, what they're saying in short summaries. Being nonverbal, kind of watching the arched eyebrows or the look of shock when they say they haven't checked their blood glucose in a month. Reflective listening, there's a piece here that show you some stems. Great way to kind of go back over what the patient is telling you. So you might end up saying something like, so you're saying that it's hard to get in all your medications on time. It sounds like you're having a real problem getting your insulin in during the prescribed time. So what I hear you saying is that with 5 medications, it's really hard to get them all in. So, again, being able to reflect back to them in listening is a way of encouraging what they're trying to say. Empathy is another way of helping with motivational interviewing. It's the E of CORE. Setting up goals that help them help you understand emotions. Empathy is not sympathy. Sympathy is, I feel sorry for you. You know, I hate that you feel this way, and, you know, it's a tough life, etc. Empathy is, I want to put myself in your shoes for a day or a week, and let me see if I can go through your experiences. So patient experiences have to be understood. It's hard to get this down and attend to what they're trying to say unless you really work at this. Example of empathy could be, you know, you seem pretty frustrated over having to go through all this. Most people I know would really be, you know, distressed about this. One of the things I would caution you about in something like this is saying, I know how you feel. If you don't have diabetes, if you don't have asthma, you don't know how someone feels who has diabetes or asthma. What you can say is, in working with a lot of patients and a lot of people, for example, with diabetes, I think I understand what you're going through. It's got to really be hard to have to check your blood glucose 4 times a day. And it's got to be frustrating when you try this over and over and end up with the same results. Just having that amount of empathy is a very powerful tool in your arsenal of working with patients for behavior change. So if you remember this part of intervening in between, now we have something a little different. What we have is the clinician giving the recommendations of walking 5 miles a week or taking 5 medications a day. The patient's still kind of whirling around, but he comes back to you, and then you're sitting down with him and saying, okay, so let's go over what the physician's recommendations were. You have five medications. Do you understand what each one of them are for? Are you having trouble getting any of your medications in? You may end up with questions like, you know, this is a fear I have. Insulin, my grandmother started on insulin, she died a week later. My dad started on insulin, and he lost his leg a month later. You have a chance at that point to explain, you know, what the issues were, that insulin's never harmed a cell in a human body. But, you know, unfortunately, diabetes, you know, not controlled well does those kind of things. So that's a very important part of reinforcing the recommendations of the physician. And we call it intervening in between, because this patient may only see this doctor, possibly once every 3 months. And he's on his own. He needs someone to come back into and reinforce this to say, you're doing a great job. If he left the physician with orders to walk a mile every day and he comes back to you and says, you know what, I hate walking, but I'll try it. And maybe you set a goal that's a little less and help him understand what solutions there could be. A solution for this guy could be, do you have anybody that you could walk with? And his answer could be, you know, we used to do that, and great, I'll call him. We'll talk about holding each other accountable. So we're working through solutions for barriers that pop up for whatever it might be. A solution for this guy who forgets to take his lipid therapy every night at bedtime is to set the pill bottle and a glass by his toothbrush every night, so that, you know, it's the one thing he's going to do at night is brush his teeth, drink a glass of water, and take his medication. Maybe we pumped up adherence, you know, 25% just by doing that. So that's what's important, I think, when we talk about having this crew. And this is where pharmacists need to plant themselves in the minds of people that are making healthcare decisions. Overall, we create a collaborative plan, the C. The C in CORE is a collaborative plan. Let's create a plan that will work for you. What will, do you want to set as a goal? What can we mark down, for example, if it's exercise, what can we mark down as a goal that we can put for you? Let's go out 2 weeks and carry out the plan, and let's meet back and see how you're doing. If it's not working for you, let's change it. Let's monitor results, and let's change up the game plan a little bit. We adapt the plan, and we move to another goal. If that were medication taking, it would be, you're on five medications. Now that you understand all of these, let's work with them. See you in 2 weeks. Do an evaluation and see if there's any problems. You know, are there side effects we need to address? Are there issues of just timing that we need to address? If it is, let's change them. So Plan, Do, Study, Act, PDSA is what we call this. When we sit down with a patient, we do a PDSA, you do it in business all the time, of let's try something, let's talk about it, agree, go out and work with it, look at the results, and then put it into motion and look to see how well it worked. The goals that we do set need to be what we call SMART goals. If you look on the left there, SMART, they need to be specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. If we're going to set a goal of exercise, let's talk about we're going to walk around the block two times a day or two times 5 days a week, and we're going to start today, and it's realistic. I can do that. I can achieve that. I can't walk a mile a day. We'll move up to that later on. So with the motivational interviewing process, how do we know we really got this right? And probably the best way, I think, to evaluate how well you're doing is when you're sitting down interviewing a patient, you're talking to them, and you're having a conversation with them, what you're going to find are some certain things. One, you're talking more slowly. You're not trying to spit out everything you can get. Probably the most important thing that I could tell you is that the patient is talking much more than you are. One of the greatest pieces of advice I ever got from a diabetes educator, when I asked her, how can I be as good as I can possibly be? She said, just remember one simple thing. If you're ever talking more than the patient is, you're doing something wrong. So patient's talking more than you, you're probably on the right track. If the patient's starting to talk behavior change, you're probably on a better track. If they're saying, you know, one thing I could do is maybe link up with my neighbor across the street. We're always talking to each other and saying we're going to do this. Maybe I could link up with them, and we'll set a goal to go out and exercise 5 days a week. So if they're talking behavior change, and in nirvana, in the best of worlds, what you really mentally do is you kind of hold up this blank canvas, and the patient is painting in the solutions as they're talking to you. So that's one of the things I think that tends to work well, is let them do the talking. Let them arrive at their solutions and then go from there. Peter Drucker, I think one of the gurus of business, and it doesn't matter whether it's business or whether it's talking to patients or anything else, came up with something that that I think we all need to remember, that the most important thing in communication is to hear what isn't being said. As you're sitting down with a patient, listen to what's not being said. Is there fear there? Is there reluctance there? Are you catching something? And you only do that with skill, with practice, and by giving them your complete attention. So after we have the motivational interviewing aspect of this, we need to talk about disseminating information. How do our patients learn the best? And think about how you learn the best. I'll give you an example of this. The guy down there on the right bears a striking resemblance to me, and the guy up on the left is one of the leading endocrinologists in the country. About probably once a year, we tend to sit down at a given meeting and become the blues brothers. I love to play the blues. I love to wanted to learn how to play the guitar at a higher level. So what I decided to do was take a higher level of actually take lessons for the first time in my life. And I went to a instructor, called him up, and he was a master guitarist. He told me this, and see if this rings a bell. He told me he was a master guitarist about five times before I ever sat down for my first lesson. And so what I told him as I sat down is that I want to learn three blues songs, and I want to be able to play them very good. And he said, I can't work like that. You have to learn my music. I'm going to give you 12 pages to go home and rehearse with. You have to learn the notes. You have to learn the theory, and then we'll talk about learning your songs. Well, I went home, set the pages up on a shelf, and he never heard from him again. I'm sure he thought Jerry's noncompliant. He doesn't care about learning the guitar. He didn't really care. He thought he did, and he's not going to try. What he didn't understand is that I wanted to try hard enough that I went to another instructor who said, how do you want to learn? And I said, I want to learn these three songs. And he said, tell you what we'll do. With a little bit of theory, we'll teach you the three songs, and by learning these three with my theory, you'll learn other stuff. That's the way I learned to play. And the fact is I had to learn to play the way I needed to learn. So if you ask me to play the Star Spangled Banner, reading this music, there's not a prayer. I can't read music, but I'm okay. Jimi Hendrix couldn't learn or didn't know music. Clapton didn't know music when he started. If you told me the chords, I could get that down. If you told me tablature, I could work that out. That's the way I would have to learn. I'm more simplistic. Honestly, I'm not interested in learning music. Some people aren't interested in all the aspects of chronic care, but they want to learn the way they want to learn. And it may be video. It may be verbal. It may be with handouts, but ask how they learn the best, and that way you're in their arena. So communication is very important in that we're not using jargon, A1C, antihypertensive. These things aren't spelled out clearly to a lot of patients. We need to connect to their world, and this teach-back technique is important. You know, the one thing that we try to end up when I'm doing a one-on-one with someone is I try to remember to phrase it this way. I want to make sure I'm clear in explaining this to you. To make sure that I explain this correctly, can you tell me what you're going to do when you get home? If you ask them if they understand, I've talked to some very learned people who nodded their head yes but didn't understand. No one wants to appear dumb. So we tend to say, I want to make sure I explain this correctly. Can you tell me what you're going to do when you leave here? So to kind of finish this up, we talk about exploring the problem. one question that's very important. What's the hardest thing in caring for whatever your chronic disease is? You want to ask an opening question? Ask that question and sit back and listen. You'd be surprised at the answers. It could well be the expense. It could be my family doesn't support me. It could be several things. But find that out first. Clarify the feelings. How do you feel about taking insulin? What's your biggest worry about taking insulin? We tend to ask on a regular basis, what do you know about insulin? What do you think about insulin before we even start? Because there's a lot of myths out there that we need to address. Third step is develop a plan. You know, what would you like to do about the problem that you have? What do you think your options are? How can I help you? What would happen if you do nothing? And let them talk. Let them have the time to work through their feelings. And finally, a commitment to action. What are you going to do when you leave here today? Tell me what you think is going to be your biggest problem. How will you know if you're successful? And then we need to send them out, let them try this for a couple of weeks, and evaluate their progress in doing what we've talked to. Again, plan, do, study, act. So the take-home message for all of this is everyone wants to live a long and happy life. Our patients are more confused about their chronic care and about what they're supposed to do than unmotivated. Everyone wants to be healthy. We have to admit that management of a chronic disease is a tough issue, that our patients face a lot of obstacles out there, and those obstacles change day to day and patient to patient. But having these good conversations, the ones that are open-ended, lead to really good outcomes. And if you have just time for one question, if you only have time to talk to a patient in one point, ask them this: what do you find the most challenging about managing your diabetes, about managing your asthma? And then do something very important: listen to the answer. So with that, I would like to thank you for your time and thank you for listening to me. And Tina, at this point, we're going to turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Jerry. That's very great information, and we should have asked you to bring your guitar along to hear one of your songs.
That's later.
Angie, we'd like to open up the call for questions, please.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press 0 followed by a 1 on your phone's keypad. Again, to ask a question, please press 01 now. We'll hold for just a moment while our system compiles our responses. And we do have a question from Dilworth Drug. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jamie. Thank you so much, Jerry, for your information. My question is in reference to the implementation of receiving payment for any of the counseling services that your program is offering. Have you experienced any reluctance with patients, whether they pay for cash or whether you try and bill via an MTM service for this? Just trying to see where everybody sits as far as, you know, this implementation is going, because it's a great service and we definitely want to make sure that our pharmacists, you know, and anyone is involved gets proper reimbursement for this.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, as much as we all love doing this, and I don't think I've talked to a pharmacist in a group ever who didn't say, I want to do this. But this works only for so long until we have to figure out that it's going to increase our bottom line, and it's going to allow us to do this. The passion wears off when you're spending time and you're having to play catch up. We are getting reimbursed. We get reimbursed, of course, you know, for the MTM. We have a diabetes education recognized program through AADE, and I couldn't encourage, you know, any stronger than pharmacists out there becoming a part of. If you're working with diabetes patients, for example, being a part of DSMT program that is recognized, and you can find out more about that by going to AADE, but you can also go to NCPA and look at their DASPA program, because that's a good start. There's a lot of good things that come out of that. there's opening up a lot of opportunities right now. For example, again, I mentioned Centers for Disease Control right now, AADE also, and even private industry is looking for people to work at preventing some of these diseases. We know right now that through a fairly straightforward program of nutrition and exercise, that we can prevent diabetes from occurring at at-risk patients in type 2 58% of the time. Now, there's nothing in the world that wouldn't keep me from going outside of Gainesville, Texas, and talking to Weber Aircraft and saying that I want to work with all your patients that are at risk, that are overweight, or that are at risk for diabetes. Take them through a course. We'll charge them $50 for a group and X number of dollars for individual, and creating a private contract. Also, you're looking at there's some major insurers that are looking for people to do exactly what we've talked about today, healthcare coaching, counseling. It's just a matter of continually working the web, networking, going through organizations like NCPA and saying, what are my opportunities to work with this? And also, I think we forget the fact that patients honestly will pay for this. If we say in a professional manner, these are my charges to work with you on what you have. So reimbursement used to be something that we looked at and thought, well, that'd be nice. Now it's absolute a reality. Pharmacists are getting reimbursed, but we're still on the cutting edge. We still have to really, keep kicking on the door to get our foot in it and work our way in. But it's being done.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for listening.
And we have no further questions at this time.
All right, very good. Well, thanks, everyone, for dialing in to this month's call. The slides and a recording of today's call will be available on the NCPA website later this week. Stay tuned to NCPA's eNews Weekly and the Simplify My Meds newsletter for announcements about upcoming Lunch and Learn dates and topics. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may now disconnect.